Women have been playing football for more than 150 years, and it's always been political. Some have been celebrated, but others have been ridiculed, criticized, and forgotten. This is the Forgotten 11, the hidden history of women's football.
I'm not going to the White House. No.
You know, there was a lot of critics talking about us, but we're back, so it's not been that long.
Give me the effing ball.
Playing like a girl means you're a badass.
Today's episode is about a woman you've probably heard of, but possibly you haven't heard the whole story. Her story is a little complicated, and to tell it, we have to delve into one of the worst parts of American history. Much of her story happens before the invention of football, and she didn't play. But sometimes I just have to tell another story. I remember hearing somewhere that immortality, in the conventional sense, is impossible. But there's another way to become immortal. When people speak your name and tell your story, that's another way to become immortal. Araminta Ross was born in or around 1822 in Maryland. She was black and she was a slave. Slavery before the United States was not great, but most societies, the Romans, the Chinese, had some respect for slaves. Laws protected them from abuse and murder. In the United States, slave owners could do pretty much anything they wanted to an enslaved person. And many of the slave owners treated these people terribly. By the time she was 11 or 12, Araminta, or Minty Ross, had scars from being whipped. She helped raise her owner's children, and later she worked in the fields and trapping animals in the nearby woods. She often ran away and wore layers of clothes to help soften the frequent whippings. When she was 12 years old, a slave owner threw a heavy metal weight at another slave and missed. The weight hit Minty Ross in the head, cracking her skull. Despite a broken skull and the fact that she was bleeding, she was given no medical attention for days. She suffered from severe headaches for the rest of her life. After this injury, she began to have visions and vivid dreams of God. She seemed to fall into trances and heard God's voice, kind of like Joan of Arc. Ross was raised a Christian and took particular note of the stories of the enslaved Israelites and their righteous fight for freedom. Many American slaves were Christians. There are a couple reasons for this, and it's important for our story today. So the slave owners thought that this was a good idea. They thought of themselves something like parents or guides for their slaves. They thought the slaves, left on their own, would do terrible things. And if they taught them about Christian salvation, the slaves would look for happiness in the next life, rather than this current life. The slaves, on the other hand, had different ideas. In the 1800s, not all of the U.S. allowed slavery. Half the country had outlawed slavery. That was known as the North. The South was the half of the country that allowed slavery. So if a slave got to the North, theoretically, he or she would be free. The story of Moses leading the Israelites out of Egypt obviously had a new meaning for the American slaves. And not a little of it was inspirational, if not instructional. Minty Ross, in 1849, at the age of about 27, escaped to the North to Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Okay, but think about that. How? When was the last time you walked 600 miles at night with no map, hiding out the whole time while being chased by slave hunters and dogs? And oh yeah, most slaves couldn't read or write. How do you just escape? The The Aboriginal people in Australia have a really interesting map system. It's called song lines. The idea of a song line is that if you sing the song right, the song line will describe the landscape where you are and tell you where to go next to find water or shelter. The song will describe what you're looking at and teach you about where you are. The longest song lines cover more than 2,000 miles across that continent. The American slaves didn't have song lines. Slaves with books or newspapers or even a piece of paper could be whipped or beaten. Slaves that spoke of escape or revolt were severely punished. So how could the slaves convey needed information about escaping to the north? There's something we now call code switching. It's a cultural phenomenon where we speak and act differently with different people. Code switching is particularly used by vulnerable people, whether it's an ethnic minority, a disempowered person, people who feel less safe in certain situations. You probably do it a little, maybe at work or at school. You just don't open up the same way as you do when you're with friends and family. But what if that code switching was potentially fatal? If you let too much out, you or others might die. American slaves had a secret, which even today is hidden from most people. They could sing spiritual songs, gospel songs. And the slave masters thought it was actually a good idea. Telling and retelling the stories of the Bible, they thought, would keep the slaves content. Salvation in the next life, if not this one. Here's an example.
When the sun comes back, when the first quail calls, follow the dragon gold. For the old man is waiting for, carry you to freedom, follow. Well, a riverbank is a mighty good road. Dead trees show you the way. Left foot, peg foot, traveling on. Follow the drink and go.
Go back and listen to that again if you like, because that, my friend, is a map. The slave owners would think that the drinking gourd was a cup, like in communion. The old man was God. The riverbank was the righteous path. But it's not. The gourd is the Big Dipper, which points to the North Star. So the song is telling slaves to travel at night, to look for the Big Dipper in the sky, to find the North Star, and head towards it until they have to cross a river. The river, often called the Jordan in other songs, is the Ohio River. North of the Ohio River, they would be free. And the old man wasn't God. He was Moses. The slaves could also put all sorts of information in the song to describe local dangers and conditions. Now, before Minty Ross escaped to the north, she had been married to a man named Tubman. And sometime between the marriage and her escape, she started using her mother's name, which was Harriet, shortened to Rhett. So maybe you guessed, this is the story of Harriet Tubman. Before Tubman escaped, she sang a song to a friend and fellow slave. I'll meet you in the morning. I'm bound for the promised land. These songs, some of the only free expressions slaves were allowed, were filled with hidden meaning, conveying secrets right out in the open if you knew how to listen. A people that were denied all human dignity, not even allowed to record their own names or have family names, found a secret and subtle way to record some part of their history and teach others how to follow the path to freedom.
Yeah.
Dumps are not exactly the nicest places to hang out, but they do offer one great advantage for the escaping slave. Hiding from tracking dogs. Now, I'm a big fan of dogs, but if you've ever met a trained tracking dog, they are amazing. Imagine looking at a beach, millions of grains of sand, and you can see instantly the single grain of sand that's a slightly different color. That's how well tracking dogs like bloodhounds can smell. But they can't track your smell through water. Because first, the water moves, unlike the ground, and second, water helps break down the scent. There's another secret here in this part of history. All of the United States, in both the North and the South, there were people who objected to slavery. There was heated political debate in the newspapers. There were abolitionists who wanted to end slavery. And there were groups of people who were slowly, secretly, one slave at a time, ending slavery. The secret network of people who lived from the Gulf of Mexico all the way up to Ontario and what would later become Canada. These people would offer hiding places, food, sometimes transport to the next house. Or it could be secret directions hidden in the pattern of a quilt left outside to dry. There's a whole history of the Underground Railroad sewn into quilts in secret codes. Seemingly random squares actually pointing directly at safe houses, if you knew what to look for. This secret network formed in the late 1700s and helped an unknown number of slaves escape to the north. Harriet Tubman's first stop in her escape was probably a local Quaker community, because they were known to be against slavery, and many Quakers were part of the Underground Railroad. Once Tubman crossed into Pennsylvania, she said, "When I found I had crossed that line, I looked at my hands to see if I was the same person. There was such a glory over everything. The sun came like gold through the trees and over the fields, and I felt like I was in heaven." Soon after she escaped, the United States passed the Fugitive Slave Act, which said that even in the states that had abolished slavery, escaped slaves could be captured and sent back to the slave states. So all the people who had escaped to the north were again in danger. Many fled north to Ontario, but Harriet Tubman did not. "I was a stranger in a strange land," she said. "My father, my mother, my brothers and sisters, and friends were in Maryland. But I was free. They should be free." In December 1850, Tubman heard that her niece and two young children would be sold in a Maryland auction. And she had a plan. She had been working and saving money in Philadelphia. She went back to Baltimore, Maryland, and hid with her brother-in-law, her niece's husband. His name was John Boley. He was a free black man. At auction, Boley would bid for his wife and win the bidding, and then the two would grab the children and flee to a nearby safe house. Once night fell, they took a canoe 60 miles to Baltimore to meet Harriet Tubman. Tubman then took the family on to Philadelphia. Early the next year, she returned to Maryland to rescue her brothers, and then again to rescue her husband. He had remarried and refused to go, so Tubman found other slaves and led them out to Pennsylvania in freedom. Because the North was also dangerous now, Tubman often led escaping slaves onto Ontario. In December 1851, she was leading 11 people north when they stopped at the house of Frederick Douglass, a famous former slave, author, abolitionist, and all-around important person. Douglass had this to say to her: "The difference between us is very marked. Most that I have done and suffered in the service of our cause has been in public, and I have received much encouragement at every step of the way. You, on the other hand, have labored in a private way. I have wrought in the day, you in the night. The midnight sky and the silent stars have been the witnesses of your devotion to freedom and of your heroism. Excepting John Brown of sacred memory, I know of no one who has willingly encountered more perils and hardships to serve our enslaved people than you have. More on John Brown in a minute. From 1851 to 1862, Tubman made at least 13 trips to the South. She guided 70 people out and gave specific instructions to at least 50 others on how they might find their way. Tubman was something like James Bond before James Bond. She often ran into white people who might know who she was or who had known her as a slave. She had disguises and subterfuge, misdirecting attention so she could carry on her work. One example, when she was perhaps about to be caught, she found a chicken and pulled some of the chicken's feathers out, which of course hurt the chicken, and the chicken made a lot of noise about it. Everyone on the street watched the chicken, screaming and squawking, while she just walked out of town. Tubman would only travel in the winter, when the nights were long and it was cold, so fewer people would be out. She always left with her passengers on Saturday night because there were no newspapers printed on Sundays, and so no escape notices published until Monday morning. This gave her and her passengers a 36-hour head start. With all this, she earned a nickname. Notice that in the original version, the line is, "Tell those pharaohs, let my people go." Egypt only ever had one pharaoh at a time, like kings. So those pharaohs are the slaveholders. Tubman was certainly respected by people for her accomplishments, but she wasn't done yet. In April 1858, she met a white man named John Brown. John Brown was a different kind of abolitionist. He didn't believe in changing laws to abolish slavery. His plan was to recruit former slaves and current slaves, arm them, and rebel against the slaveholders, bringing freedom to the slaves through armed conflict. Tubman was on board with this idea. John Brown referred to Tubman as General Tubman. Tubman returned to Canada to recruit former slaves, and Brown, Tubman, and others tried to recruit people and raise funds for a revolt. The plan was straightforward. Brown would train former slaves as soldiers in Canada. At the designated time, these soldiers would travel to the town of Harper's Ferry, Virginia. They would capture the federal armory and distribute the weapons to the slaves in the area and continue marching and freeing slaves until there was a general rebellion to free all of the slaves. Just before the raid, John Brown told his men, "We stand 9 chances to 1 to be killed, but there are moments when men can do more dead than alive." On Sunday, October 16th, 1859, John Brown and his men arrived at Harper's Ferry. In the middle of the night, they captured the armory and most of the troops stationed there. But soon, the U.S. government knew about this, and they were sending in Marines under the command of a United States colonel named Robert E. Lee. By Tuesday morning, few slaves had shown up to fight, possibly because they hadn't been given clear instructions on where to go. And John Brown and his men were surrounded. 10 had been killed, 7, including Brown, were wounded, and 5 escaped. John Brown was tried for treason by the United States, found guilty, and hanged on December 2, 1859. Less than 18 months later, the North and the South of the United States were at war over the issue of slavery.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave. His soul goes marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His soul goes marching on.
Today, many people argue that the American Civil War was fought over states' rights, meaning that each state in the U.S. had the right to decide laws differently. And that's pretty much a lie. All of the states that rebelled against the United States and became members of the Confederacy cited the North's opposition to slavery as the cause of the war. John Brown just started the war earlier than his government. And once it did start, Tubman immediately signed up to help. She became a nurse and a cook, but generals soon realized that her knowledge of the terrain, her experience on the Underground Railroad, and her ability to blend into the local community made her essential to the war effort. In 1863, Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, declaring that all slaves were now free. And Tubman took that news as a doubling down by the North. She doubled down as well. Working directly for the Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, she led a band of scouts around Port Royal, South Carolina. They mapped the area, identified locals, resources, plantations, and towns. On June 2, 1863, Tubman guided Colonel James Montgomery and his troops in 3 large steamboats to a collection of plantations near Port Royal on the Combahee River. She led the raid. Northern troops set fire to the fields, seized food and supplies. Tubman had told the local slaves when she had scouted the area, "When you hear the whistle, get to the boats." This was the next part of the plan. The boats sounded their whistles. As you can imagine, all hell broke loose. Rather than walk hundreds of miles through the dark with the constant fear of being caught or killed, here was Moses herself with 3 large boats and soldiers to protect them. The slaves of the Combahee River plantations ran for their lives. They carried whatever belongings they could, pigs, chickens, their children. They ran past Confederate soldiers who were shooting at them, past the slave owners who were whipping them. Tubman later said, "I've never seen such a sight." In all, more than 750 people were saved at the Combahee River Raid. Many of the rescued men were convinced by Tubman to enlist in the North's army to help free the other slaves. It was 2 more years before the South surrendered, and Harriet Tubman was there until the end. When the war ended, she didn't retire. She continued her work helping the poor, the sick, and the elderly. She took whatever she had to help others. Despite being a war hero, she never received a soldier's pension. More than 40 years after the war, she finally received a nurse's pension, and a friend helped her write a biography, which made her a little money. In 1869, she was taking a train to New York, and the conductor told her to move to the back of the train. She refused and showed the man both her paid ticket and proof that she was both Harriet Tubman and a war hero. The conductor didn't care and tried to force her out, so she grabbed a railing to stay put. The conductor and some of the passengers broke her arm and threw her into the baggage car. When Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat during the Civil Rights Movement in the 1950s, she studied this story of Tubman. Tubman also became a women's suffragist and worked with Susan B. Anthony. In 1908, in Auburn, New York, where she had lived much of her later life, she opened the Harriet Tubman Home for the Aged. Every moment of Tubman's life was dedicated to helping others. The enslaved, those less able, those less fortunate. On March 10th, 1913, at around the age of 90, Harriet Tubman was surrounded by friends and family. Her last words, "I go to prepare a place for you."
I do what I can when I can while I can for my people. While the clouds roll back and the stars fill the night, that's when I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new home, far across the river. Can you hear freedom calling, calling me to answer? Gonna keep on keeping on, I can feel it. Salvation, and I fight with the strength that I got until I die.